Chapter 29. Simply because they change and hide their names, do not give their right age, and by their own admission go about without allowing themselves to be recognized, there is no logic that can deny that they necessarily must exist. Heinrich Neuhaus, Pia et Ultimissima Admonestatio de Fratribus Rosae Crucis, Nimirum, An sint, quales sint, unde nomen illud sibi asciverunt. Danzig, Schmidlin, 1618, French edition, 1623, page 5. Diotelevi used to say that Chesed was the sephira of grace and love, white fire, south wind. The other evening in the periscope, I thought that those last days with Amparo and Bahia belonged under that sign. You remember so much while you wait for hours and hours in the darkness. I remembered especially one of the last evenings. We had walked through so many alleys and squares that our feet ached, and we went to bed early, but we didn't feel like sleeping. Amparo, huddled against the pillow in the fetal position, was pretending to read one of my little pamphlets on the Umbanda, propping it on her knees. From time to time she would roll lazily onto her back, legs spread, the book balanced on her belly, listening to me read from the book on the Rosicrucians. I was trying to involve her in my discoveries. It was a mild evening. As Belbo, exhausted with literature, might have put it in one of his files, there was naught but a lovely sighing of the wind. We had splurged on a good hotel. There was a view of the sea from the window, and the still-lighted closet kitchen offered the comforting sight of the basket of tropical fruit we had bought at 4 that morning. It says that in 1614 an anonymous work appeared in Germany entitled Allgemeine und Generalreformation, or General and Common Reform of the Entire Universe, followed by Fama Fraternitatis of the Honorable Confraternity of the Rosy Cross, addressed to all learned men and sovereigns of Europe, together with a brief reply by Herr Hasselmeier, who for this reason was cast into prison by the Jesuits and then placed in irons on a galley. Now printed and made known to all the sincere of heart, published in Kassel by Wilhelm Bessel. A little long, isn't it? Apparently all titles were like that in the 17th century. Lina Wertmüller wrote them too. Anyway, this was a satirical work, a fairy tale about a general reform of mankind, partly plagiarized from Traiano Boccolino's Ragguagli di Parnaso. But it contained a manifesto of about a dozen languages, the Fama Fraternitatis, which was republished separately a year later, at the same time as another manifesto, this one in Latin. Confessio Fraternitatis, Rosei Crucis, Ad Eruditos Europae. Both present the confraternity of the Rosy Cross and talk about its founder, a mysterious C.R. Only later, and from other sources, was it learned or presumed that C.R. was one Christian Rosenkreutz. Why didn't they use the full name? The whole thing's full of initials. They didn't use anybody's full name. They're all GGMPI. One is called PD, an affectionate nickname. Anyway, the pamphlet tells of the formative years of C.R., who first visited the Holy Sepulchre, then set off for Damascus, moved on to Egypt, and from there went to Fez, which must have been one of the sanctuaries of Moslem wisdom at the time. There, our Christian, who already knew Greek and Latin, learned Oriental languages, physics, mathematics, and the sciences of nature, accumulating all the millennial wisdom of the Arabs and Africans, as well as Kabbalah and magic. He also translated a mysterious Liber M into Latin, and thus came to know all the secrets of the macrocosm and the microcosm. For 2 centuries, everything Oriental had been fashionable, especially if it was incomprehensible. They always go for that. Hungry, frustrated, exploited, mystery cocktail coming up. Here. She passed me a joint. This is good stuff. See, you also seek to lose yourself. Except that I know it's only chemical. No mystery at all. It works even if you don't know Hebrew. Come here. Wait. Next, Rosenkreutz went to Spain, where he picked up more occult doctrines, claiming that he was drawing closer to the center of all knowledge. In the course of these travels, which for an intellectual of the time was a sort of total wisdom trip, he realized that what was needed in Europe was an association that would guide rulers along the paths of wisdom and good. Very original. Well worth it, all that studying. I want some cold mamaya. In the fridge. Do me a favor, you go. I'm working. If you're working, that makes you the aunt, so be a good aunt and get some provisions. Mamaya is pleasure, so the grasshopper should go. Otherwise, I'll go and you read. Oh, no, Jesus, I hate the white man's culture. I'll go. Amparo went to the little kitchen, and I enjoyed seeing her against the light. Meanwhile, C.R. was on his way back from Germany, but instead of devoting himself to the transmutation of metals, of which his now immense knowledge made him capable, he decided to dedicate himself to spiritual reformation. He therefore founded the confraternity, inventing a language and magic writing that would be the foundation of the wisdom of generations of brothers to come. No, no, I'll spill it on the book. Put it in my mouth. Come on, no tricks, silly. That's right. Oh, God, how good Mamaya is. Rosenkreuzliche Mutiaya. Anyway, what the first Rosicrucians wrote in the first few years could have enlightened the world. Why? What did they write? There's the rub. The manifesto doesn't say. It leaves you with your mouth watering. But it was important. So important, it had to remain secret. The bastards. No. Hey, hey, cut that out. Well, as the Rosicrucians gained more and more members, they decided to spread to the four corners of the earth, vowing to heal the sick without charging, to dress according to the customs of each country, never wearing clothes that would identify them, to meet once a year, and to remain secret for 100 years. Tell me, what kind of reformation were they after? I mean, hadn't there just been one? What was Luther then, shit? No, you're wrong. This was before the Protestant Reformation. There's a note here. It says that a thorough reading of the Fama and the Confessio evinces, shows, makes evident. Stop that, I'm trying to talk about the Rosy Cross. It's serious. It evinces. Rosenkreuz was born in 1378 and died in 1484 at the ripe old age of 106. And it's not hard to guess that the secret confraternity made a considerable contribution to the Reformation that celebrated its centenary in 1615. In fact, Luther's coat of arms includes a rose and a cross. Some imagination. You expect Luther to use a burning giraffe or a limp watch? We're all children of our own time. I found out whose child I am, so shut up and let me go on. Around 1604, the Brethren of the Rosy Cross were rebuilding a part of their palace or secret castle, and they came across a plaque with a big nail driven into it. When they pulled out the nail, part of the wall collapsed, and they saw a door with something written on it in big letters. Post centum viginti annos patebo. I had already learned this from Belbo's letter, but still couldn't help reacting. My God! What is it? It's like a Templar document that... A story I never told you about a colonel who... What of it? The Templars must have copied from the Rosicrucians. But the Templars came first. Then the Rosicrucians copied from the Templars. What would I do without you, darling? That Allier's ruined you. You're looking everywhere for revelation. Me? I'm not looking for anything. And a good thing, too. Watch out for the opiate of the masses. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. Go ahead, laugh. So what did these idiots say? These idiots learned everything they knew in Africa. Weren't you listening? And while they were in Africa, they started packing us up and sending us here. Thank God. Otherwise you might have been born in Pretoria. I kissed her. Beyond the door, I went on, they found a sepulchre with 7 sides and 7 corners, miraculously illuminated by an artificial sun. In the middle was a circular altar decorated with various mottos or emblems, on the order of Nequaquam Vacuum. Quack, quack, what? Signed Donald Duck? It's Latin. It means the void does not exist. That's good to know. Otherwise, think of the horror. Do me a favor and turn on the fan. Animula, vagula, blandula. But it's winter. Only for you people of the wrong hemisphere, darling. For me it's July. Please, the fan. It's not because you're a woman, just that it's on your side of the bed. Thanks. Anyway, under the altar, they found Rosenkreuz's body intact. In his hand was a copy of Book One, crammed with infinite knowledge. Too bad the world can't read it, the manifesto says. Otherwise, gulp, wow, brr, squish. Ouch! As I was saying, the manifesto ends by promising that a huge treasure remains to be discovered, along with stupendous revelations about the ties between the macrocosm and the microcosm. As I was saying, the manifesto ends by promising that a huge treasure remains to be discovered, along with stupendous revelations about the ties between the macrocosm and the microcosm. And don't think that these were a bunch of tacky alchemists offering to show us how to make gold. No, that was small potatoes. They were aiming higher in every sense of the word. The manifesto announced that the Fama was being distributed in 5 languages, and soon to appear on this screen, the Confessio. The brothers awaited replies and reviews from learned and ignorant alike. Write, telephone, send in your names, and we'll see if you're worthy to share our secrets, of which we have given you only the faintest notion. Sub umbra alarum tuarum Jehovah. Which means? It's a form of conclusion. Over and out. It sounds as if the Rosicrucians were dying to tell what they had learned, and were anxiously waiting for the right listener, but not one word about what it was they knew. Like that fellow whose picture was in the ad we saw on the plane. Send me $10, and I'll tell you how to become a millionaire. And it's no lie, he has discovered the secret. And so have I. Listen, you better read on. You're acting as if we had just met tonight. With you, it's always like the first time. Ah, but I don't get too familiar with the first one who comes along. Anyway, you have quite a collection now. First Templars, then Rosicrucians. You haven't read Plekhanov by any chance. No, I'm waiting to discover his sepulcher 120 years from now, unless Stalin buried him with tractors. Idiot, I'm taking a bath. Chapter 30. And the famous confraternity of the Rosy Cross declares even now that throughout the universe delirious prophecies circulate. In fact, the moment the ghost appeared, though Fama and Confessio proved that this was a mere invention of idle minds, it produced a hope of universal reform, and generated things partly ridiculous and absurd, partly incredible. Thus upright and honest men of various countries exposed themselves to contempt and derision in order to lend open support, or to reveal themselves to these brothers through the mirror of Solomon, or in some other occult way. Christoph von Bezold, Appendix to Tommaso Campanella, von der Spanischen Monarchie, 1623. The best came later, and when Amparo returned, I was able to give her a foretaste of wondrous events. It's an incredible story. The manifestos appeared in an age teeming with texts of that sort. Everyone was seeking renewal, a golden century, a cocaine of the spirit. Some pored over magic texts, others labored at forges, melting metals, others sought to rule the stars, and still others invented secret alphabets and universal languages. In Prague, Rudolf II turned his court into an alchemistic laboratory, invited Comenius and John Dee, the English court astrologer who had revealed all the secrets of the cosmos in the few pages of his Monas Hieroglyphica. Are you with me? To the end of time. Rudolf's physician was a man named Michael Meyer, who later wrote a book of visual and musical emblems, the Atalanta Fugens, an orgy of philosophers' eggs, dragons biting their tails, sphinxes. Nothing was more luminous than a secret cipher. Everything was the hieroglyph of something else. Think about it. Galileo was dropping stones from the Tower of Pisa, Richelieu played Monopoly with half of Europe, and in the meantime they all had their eyes peeled to read the signs of the world. Full of gravity, indeed. Something else lies beneath, or rather above, all this, something quite different. Would you like to know what? Abracadabra! Torricelli invented the barometer, but the rest of them were messing around with ballets, water games, and fireworks in the Hortus Palatinus in Heidelberg. And the 30 Years' War was about to break out. Mutter Courage must have been delighted. But even for them it wasn't all fun and games. In 1619, the Palatine Elector accepted the crown of Bohemia, probably because he was dying to rule Prague, the magic city. But the next year the Habsburgs nailed him to the White Mountain. In Prague, the Protestants were slaughtered, Comenius's house and library were burned, and his wife and son were killed. He fled from court to court, harping on how great and full of hope the idea of the Rosy Cross was. Poor man, but what did you expect him to do? Console himself with the barometer? Wait a minute, give a poor girl time to think. Who wrote these manifestos? That's the whole point. We don't know. Let's try to figure it out. How about scratching my Rosy Cross? No, between the shoulder blades. Higher. to the left. Ah, there. Yes, there. Ah. Now then. There were some incredible characters in this German environment, like Simon Studian, author of Neometria, an occult treatise on the measurements of the Temple of Solomon, Heinrich Kuhnrath, who wrote Amphitheatrum Sapientiae Eternae, full of allegories, with Hebrew alphabets and Kabbalistic labyrinths that must have inspired the authors of Fama, who were probably friends of one of the countless little utopian conventicles of Christian rebirth. One popular rumor is that the author was a man named Johann Valentin Andrei. A year later, he published The Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, but he had written that in his youth, so he must have been kicking the idea of the Rosy Cross around for quite some time. There were other enthusiasts, in Tübingen, who dreamed of the Republic of Christianopolis. Perhaps they all got together, but it sounds as if it was all in fun, a joke. They had no idea of the pandemonium they were unleashing. Andrei spent the rest of his life swearing he hadn't written the manifestos, which he claimed were a lusus, a ludibrium, a prank. It cost him his academic reputation. He grew angry, said that the Rosicrucians, if indeed they existed, were all impostors. But that didn't help. Once the manifestos appeared, it was as if people had been waiting for them. Learned men from all over Europe actually wrote to the Rosicrucians, and since there was no address, they sent open letters, pamphlets, printed volumes. In that same year, Meyer published Arcana Arcanissima, in which the Brethren of the Rosy Cross were not mentioned explicitly, but everyone was sure he was talking about them and that there was more to his book than met the eye. Some people boasted that they had read Fama in manuscript. It wasn't so easy to prepare a book for publication in those days, especially if it had engravings, but in 1616, Robert Flood, who wrote in England but printed in Leiden, so you have to figure in the time to ship the proofs, circulated Apologia Compendiaria Fraternitatem de Rosea Cruce Suspicionis et Infamiis Maculis Aspersam, Veritatem quasi fluctibus abluens et abstergens, to defend the brethren and free them from suspicion, from the slander that had been their reward. In other words, a debate was raging in Bohemia, Germany, England, and Holland, alive with couriers on horseback and itinerant scholars. And the Rosicrucians themselves? Deathly silence. Post centum viginti annos potebo maias. They watched from the vacuum of their palace. I believe it was their silence that agitated everyone so much. The fact that they didn't answer was taken as proof of their existence. In 1617, Flood wrote Tractatus Apologeticus Integritatem Societatis de Rosea Cruce Defendants, and somebody in a De Naturae Secretis in 1618 said that the time had come to reveal the secret of the Rosicrucians. And did they? Anything but. They only complicated things, explaining that if you subtracted from 1618 the 188 years promised by the Rosicrucians, you got 1430, the year when the Order of the Golden Fleece, La Toison d'Or, was established. What's that got to do with anything? I don't understand the 188 years. It seems to me it should have been 120, but mystical subtractions and additions always come out the way you want. As for La Toison d'Or, it's a reference to the Argonauts, who, an unimpeachable source once told me, had some connections with the Holy Grail and therefore with the Templars. But that's not all. Flood, who seems to have been as prolific as Barbara Cartland, brought out four more books between 1617 and 1619, including Utriusque Cosmi Historia, brief remarks on the universe, illustrated with roses and crosses throughout. Meyer then mustered all his courage and put out his Silentium Post Clamores, in which he claimed that the confraternity did indeed exist and was connected not only to La Toison d'Or, but also to the Order of the Garter. Except that he was too lowly a person to be received into it. Imagine the reaction of the scholars of Europe. If the Rosicrucians didn't accept even Meyer, the order must have been really exclusive. So now all the Sudes bent over backward to get in. In other words, everyone said the Rosicrucians existed, though no one admitted having actually seen them. Everyone wrote as if trying to set up a meeting or wheedle an audience, but no one had the courage to say, "I'm one." And some, maybe only because they had never been approached, said the order didn't exist. Others said the order existed precisely because they had been approached. And not a peep out of the Rosicrucians. Quiet as mice. Open your mouth, you need some amaya. Meanwhile, the Thirty Years' War began, and Johann Valentin André wrote Turris Babel, promising that the Antichrist would be defeated within the year, while one Irenaeus Agnostus wrote Tintinnabulum Sophorum. Tintinnabulum, I love it. Not a word of which is comprehensible. But then, Campanella, or someone acting on his behalf, declared in Spanish and Monarchy that the whole Rosy Cross business was a game of corrupt minds. And that's it. Between 1621 and 1623, they all shut up. Just like that? Just like that. They got tired of it, like the Beatles, but only in Germany. Otherwise, it's the story of a toxic cloud. It shifted to France. One fine morning in 1623, Rosicrucian manifestos appeared on the walls of Paris, informing the good citizens that the deputies of the confraternity's chief college had moved to their city and were ready to accept applications. But according to another version, the manifestos came right out and said there were 36 invisibles scattered through the world in groups of six, and that they had the power to make their adepts invisible. Hey, the 36 again! What 36? The ones in my Templar document. No imagination at all, these people. What next? Collective madness broke out. Some defended the Rosicrucians, others wanted to meet them. Still others accused them of devil worship, alchemy, and heresy, claiming that Ashtoreth had intervened to make them rich, powerful, capable of flying from place to place. The talk of the town, in other words. Smart, those brethren. Nothing like a Paris launching to make you fashionable. You're right. Listen to what happened next. Descartes, that's right, Descartes himself, had, several years before, gone looking for them in Germany. But he never found them, because, as his biographer says, they deliberately disguised themselves. By the time he got back to Paris, the manifestos had appeared, and he learned that everybody considered him a Rosicrucian. Not a good thing to be, given the atmosphere at the time. It also irritated his friend Mersenne, who was already fulminating against the Rosicrucians, calling them wretches, subversives, mages, and cabalists bent on sowing perverted doctrines. So what does Descartes do? Simply appears in public as often as possible. Since everybody can undeniably see him, he must not be a Rosicrucian, because if he were, he'd be invisible. That's method for you. Of course, denying it wouldn't have worked. The way things were, if somebody came up to you and said, "Hi there, I'm a Rosicrucian," that meant he wasn't. No self-respecting Rosicrucian would acknowledge it. On the contrary, he would deny it to his last breath. But you can't say that anyone who denies being a Rosicrucian is a Rosicrucian, because I say I'm not, and that doesn't make me one. Ah, but the denial itself is suspicious. No, it's not. What would a Rosicrucian do once he realized people weren't believing those who said they were, and that people suspected only those who said they weren't? He'd say he was, to make them think he wasn't. Damnation. So those who say they're Rosicrucians are lying, which means they really are. No, no, Amparo, we mustn't fall into their trap. Their spies are everywhere, even under this bed, so now they know that we know, and therefore they say they aren't. Darling, you're scaring me. Don't worry, I'm here, and I'm stupid, so when they say they aren't, I'll believe they are and unmask them at once. The Rosicrucian unmasked is harmless. You can shoo him out the window with a rolled-up newspaper. What about Allier? He wants us to think he's the Comte de Saint-Germain. Obviously, so we'll think he isn't. Therefore, he's a Rosicrucian. Or isn't he? Listen, Amparo, let's get some sleep. Oh, no, now I want to hear the rest. The rest is a complete mess. Everybody's a Rosicrucian. In 1627, Francis Bacon's New Atlantis was published, and readers thought he was talking about the land of the Rosicrucians, even though he never mentioned them. Poor Johann Valentin André died, still swearing up and down he wasn't a Rosicrucian, or if he said he was, he had only been kidding. But by now it was too late. The Rosicrucians were everywhere, aided by the fact that they didn't exist. Like God. Now that you mention it, let's see. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are a bunch of practical jokers who meet somewhere and decide to have a contest. They invent a character, agree on a few basic facts, and then each one's free to take it and run with it. At the end, they'll see who's done the best job. The four stories are picked up by some friends who act as critics. Matthew is fairly realistic, but insists on that Messiah business too much. Mark isn't bad, just a little sloppy. Luke is elegant, no denying that. And John takes the philosophy a little too far. Actually, though, the books have an appeal. They circulate, and when the four realize what's happening, it's too late. Paul has already met Jesus on the road to Damascus. Pliny begins his investigation ordered by the worried emperor, and a legion of apocryphal writers pretends also to know plenty. Toi, apocryphe lecteur, mon semblable, mon frère. It all goes to Peter's head. He takes himself seriously. John threatens to tell the truth. Peter and Paul have him chained up on the island of Patmos. Soon the poor man is seeing things. Help, there are locusts all over my bed. Make those trumpets stop. Where's all this blood coming from? The others say he's drunk, or maybe it's arteriosclerosis. Who knows? Maybe it really happened that way. It did happen that way. You should read some Feuerbach instead of those junk books of yours. Amparo, the sun's coming up. We must be crazy. Rosy-fingered dawn gently caresses the waves. Yes, go on, it's Yemanya. Listen, she's coming. Show me your ludibria. Oh, the tintinnabulum. You are my Atalanta fugens.
Oh, my Taurus Babel.
I want the arcana arcanissima, the golden fleece. Faire les roses comme un coquillage marin.
Shh! Silentium post clamores, she said.
Chapter 31. It is probable that the majority of the supposed rosy crosses, generally so designated, were in reality only Rosicrucians. Indeed, it is certain that they were in no way members, for the simple fact that they were members of such associations. This may seem paradoxical at first and contradictory, but is nevertheless easily comprehensible. René Guénon, Aperçu sur l'initiation, Paris, Édition traditionnelle, 1981, Roman 38, page 241. We returned to Rio, and I went back to work. One day I read in an illustrated magazine that there was an order of the ancient and accepted Rosy Cross in the city. I suggested to Amparo that we go and take a look, and reluctantly she came along. The office was in a side street. Its plate-glass window contained plaster statuettes of Cheops, Nefertiti, the Sphinx. There was a plenary session scheduled for that very afternoon, the Rosy Cross and the Umbanda. The speaker was one Professor Bramanti, referendary of the Order in Europe, secret knight of the Grand Priory and Partibus of Rhodes, Malta, and Thessalonica. We decided to go in. The room, fairly shabby, was decorated with tantric miniatures depicting the serpent Kundalini, the one the Templars wanted to reawaken with a kiss on the behind. All things considered, I thought it had hardly been worth crossing the Atlantic to discover a new world. I could have found the same things at the Picatrix office. Professor Bramanti sat behind a table covered with a red cloth, facing a rather sparse and sleepy audience. He was a corpulent gentleman who might have been described as a taper if it hadn't been for his bulk. He was already talking when we came in. His style was pompous and oratorical. He couldn't have started long before, however, because he was still discussing the Rosicrucians during the 18th dynasty, under the reign of Amos I. Four veiled masters, he said, kept watch over the race that 25,000 years before the foundation of Thebes had originated the civilization of the Sahara. The pharaoh Amos, influenced by them, established the Great White Fraternity, guardian of the antediluvian wisdom the Egyptians still retained. Bramanti claimed to have documents, naturally inaccessible to the profane, that dated back to the sages of the Temple of Karnak and their secret archives. The symbol of the rose and the cross had been conceived by the pharaoh Akhenaten. Someone has the papyrus, Bramanti said, but don't ask me who. The Great White Fraternity was ultimately responsible for the education of Hermes Trismegistus, who influenced the Italian Renaissance just as much as he later influenced Princeton Gnosis, Homer, the Druids of Gaul, Solomon, Solon, Pythagoras, Plotinus, the Essenes, the Therapeuti, Joseph of Arimathea, who took the Grail to Europe, Alcuin, King Dagobert, St. Thomas, Bacon, Shakespeare, Spinoza, Jacob Burma, Debussy, Einstein. Amparo whispered that he seemed to be missing only Nero, Cambron, Geronimo, Pancho Villa, and Buster Keaton. As for the influence of the original Rosy Cross on Christianity, Bramanti pointed out, for those who hadn't got their bearings, that it was no accident that Jesus had died on a cross. The sages of the Great White Fraternity were also the founders of the first Masonic Lodge back in the days of King Solomon. It was clear from his works that Dante had been a Rosicrucian and a Mason, as had St. Thomas, incidentally. In cantos 24 and 25 of the Paradiso, one finds the triple kiss of Prince Rosicrux, the pelican, white tunics, the same as those worn by the old men of the Apocalypse, and the three theological virtues of Masonic chapters, faith, hope, and charity. In fact, the symbolic flower of the Rosicrucians, the white rose of cantos 30 and 31, was adopted by the Church of Rome as symbol of the Mother of the Savior, hence the Rosa Mystica of the Litanies. It was equally clear that the Rosicrucians had lived on through the Middle Ages, a fact shown not only by their infiltration of the Templars, but also by far more explicit documents. Bramante cited one Kiesewetter, who demonstrated in the late 19th century that the Rosicrucians had manufactured 4 quintals of gold for the Prince Elector of Saxony in medieval times, clear proof being available on a certain page of the Theatrum Chemicum, published in Strasbourg in 1613. But few have remarked the Templar references in the legend of William Tell. Tell cuts his arrow from the branch of the mistletoe, a plant of Aryan mythology, and he hits an apple, symbol of the third eye activated by the serpent Kundalini. And we know, of course, that the Aryans came from India, where the Rosicrucians took refuge after leaving Germany. Of the various groups that claimed descent from the Great White Fraternity, often childishly, Bramante recognized just one as legitimate, the Rosicrucian Fellowship of Max Heindel, and that only because Allan Kardec had been educated in its circles. Kardec was the father of spiritualism, and it was his theosophy, which contemplated contact with the souls of the departed, that spiritually formed Umbanda spirituality, the glory of our most noble Brazil. In this theosophy, Umbanda, it seems, is a Sanskrit expression denoting the divine principle and source of life. "They tricked us again," Amparo murmured. "Not even the word Umbanda is ours. The only African thing about it is the sound." The result is Aum, or Um, which is the Buddhist Om, and also the name of God in the language of Adam. If the syllable Um is properly pronounced, it becomes a powerful mantra and produces fluid currents of harmony in the psyche through the siakra, or frontal plexus. "What's the frontal plexus?" Amparo asked. "An incurable disease?" Bramante explained that there was a big difference between true brethren of the Rosy Cross, heirs of the Great White Fraternity, obviously secret, such as the ancient and accepted order, whose unworthy representative he was, and the Rosicrucians, who claimed attachment to the Rosy Cross mystique for opportunistic reasons, lacking any justification. He urged his audience to give no credence to any Rosicrucian who called himself a brother of the Rosy Cross. Amparo remarked that one man's Rosy Cross was another man's Rosicrucian. One ill-advised member of the audience stood up and asked how Professor Bramante's order could claim to be authentic, since it violated the law of silence observed by all true adepts of the Great White Fraternity. Bramante rose to reply. "I was unaware that we had been infiltrated by the paid provocateurs of atheistic materialism. Under these circumstances, I have no more to say." And at that he walked out with a certain majesty. That evening, Allier telephoned to see how we were, and to tell us that we finally had been invited to a rite the next day. In the meantime, he suggested we have a drink. Amparo had a political meeting with her friends. I went to join Allier by myself. Chapter 32. Valentiniani nihil magis curant quam occultare quod praedicant, si tamen praedicant, qui occultant, si bona fides quaeres, concreto vulto suspenso supercilio, autum est, ajunt. Si subtiliter tentes per ambiguitates bilingues communem fidem affirmant, si scire te subos tendas, negant quidquid agnosciunt, habent artificium quo prius persuadeant, quam edoceant. Tertullian, Adversos Valentinianos. Allier invited me to a place where some ageless men still made a batida in the traditional way. In just a few steps, we left the civilization of Carmen Miranda, and I found myself in a dark room where some natives were smoking cigars thick as sausages. The tobacco, as broad, transparent leaves, was rolled into what looked like old hawser, worked with the fingertips, and wrapped in oily straw paper. It kept going out, but you could understand what it must have been like when Sir Walter Raleigh discovered it. I told him about my afternoon adventure. "So, now it's the Rosicrucians as well. Your thirst for knowledge is insatiable, my friend. But pay no attention to those lunatics. They constantly talk about irrefutable documents that no one ever produces. I know that Bramante. He lives in Milan, but he travels all over the world spreading his gospel. A harmless man, though he still believes in keys of ether. Hordes of Rosicrucians insist on that page of the Theatrum Chemicum. But if you actually take a look at it, and I might modestly add that I have a copy in my little Milanese library, there is no such quotation." "Herr Kiesewetter's a clown, then." "But much quoted. The trouble is that even the 19th-century occultists fell victim to the spirit of positivism. A thing is true only if it can be proved. Take the debate on the Corpus Hermeticum. When that document came to light in Europe in the 15th century, Pico della Mirandola, Ficino, and many other people of great wisdom immediately realized that it had to be a work of most ancient wisdom, antedating the Egyptians, antedating even Moses himself. It contained ideas that would later be expressed by Plato and by Jesus." "What do you mean, later? That's the same argument Bramante used to prove Dante was a Mason. If the corpus repeats ideas of Plato and Jesus, it must have been written after them." "You see, you're doing it too. That was exactly the reasoning of modern philologists, who also added wordy linguistic analyses intended to show that the corpus was written in the 2nd or 3rd century of our era. It's like saying that Cassandra must have been born after Homer because she predicted the destruction of Troy. The belief that time is a linear, directed sequence running from A to B is a modern illusion. In fact, it can also go from B to A, the effect producing the cause. What does coming before mean, or coming after? Does your beautiful Amparo come before or after her motley ancestors? She is too splendid, if you will allow a dispassionate opinion from a man old enough to be her father. She thus comes before. She is the mysterious origin of whatever went into her creation." "But at this point..." "It is the whole idea of point that is mistaken. Ever since Parmenides, points have been posited by science in an attempt to establish whence and whither something moves. But in fact nothing moves, and there is only one point, the one from which all others are generated at the same instant. The occultists of the 19th century, like those of our own time, naively tried to prove the truth of a thing by resorting to the methods of scientific falsehood. You must reason not according to the logic of time, but according to the logic of tradition. One time symbolizes all others, and the invisible temple of the Rosicrucians therefore exists, and has always existed, regardless of the current history, your history. The time of the final revelation is not time by the clock. Its bonds are rooted in the time of subtle history, where the befores and afters of science are of scant importance. In other words, those who maintain that the Rosicrucians are eternal are scientific fools, because they seek to prove that which must be known without proof. Do you think the worshippers we will see tomorrow night are capable of proving all the things that Kardec told them? Not at all. They simply know, because they are willing to know. If we had all retained this receptivity to secret knowledge, we would be dazzled by revelations. There is no need to wish. It's enough to be willing. But look, and forgive my banality, do the Rosicrucians exist or not?" "What do you mean by exist?" "You tell me. The Great White Fraternity, whether you call them Rosicrucians or the spiritual knighthood of which the Templars are a temporary incarnation, is a cohort of a few, a very few, elect wise men who journey through human history in order to preserve a core of eternal knowledge. History does not happen randomly. It is the work of the masters of the world, whom nothing escapes. Naturally, the masters of the world protect themselves through secrecy. And that is why anyone who says he is a master, a Rosicrucian, a Templar, is lying. They must be sought elsewhere." "Then the story goes on endlessly." "Exactly, and it demonstrates the shrewdness of the masters." "But what do they want people to know?" "Only that there's a secret. Otherwise, if everything is as it appears to be, why go on living?" "And what is the secret?" "What the revealed religions have been unable to reveal. The secret lies beyond." Chapter 33.
The visions are white, blue, white, pale red. In the end, they mingle and are all pale, the color of the flame of a white candle. You will see sparks, you will feel goose flesh all over your body. This announces the beginning of the attraction exerted on the one who fulfills the mission. Papouse, Martin de Pascailly, Paris, Chamuel, 1895, page 92. The promised evening arrived. Allier picked us up just as he had in Salvador. The tenda where the session, or hira, was to take place was in a fairly central district, if you can speak of a center in a city whose tongues of land stretch through hills and lick the sea. Seen from above, illuminated in the evening, the city looks like a head with patches of alopecia areata. Remember, this is an umbanda tonight, not a condomblé. The participants will be possessed not by Orixash, but by the Aguns, spirits of the departed, and by Exu, the African Hermes you saw in Bahia, and his companion Pompahira. Exu is a Yoruba divinity, a demon inclined to mischief and joking, but there was a trickster god in Amerind mythology, too. And who are the departed? Pretos Velos and Koboklos. The Pretos Velos are old African wise men who guided their people at the time of deportation, like Ray Congo and Pai Agostino. They are the memory of a milder phase of slavery, when the blacks, no longer animals, became family friends, uncles, grandfathers. The Caboclos, on the other hand, are Indian spirits, virgin forces representing the purity of original nature. In the Umbanda, the African Orixash stays in the background, completely syncretized with Catholic saints, and these beings alone intervene. They are the ones who produce the trance. At a certain point in the dance, the medium, the cavallo, is penetrated by a higher being and loses all awareness of self. He continues to dance until the divine being has left him, and he emerges feeling better, clean, purified. Lucky mediums, Amparo said. Lucky indeed, Allier said. They attain contact with Mother Earth. These worshippers have been uprooted, flung into the horrible melting pot of the city, and, as Spengler said, at a time of crisis, the mercantile West turns once more to the world of the Earth. We arrived. The tenda looked like an ordinary building from the outside. Here, too, you entered through a little garden, more modest than the one in Bahia, and at the door of the barracão, a kind of storehouse, was a little statue of Exu, already surrounded by propitiatory offerings. Amparo drew me aside as we went in. I figured it out, she said. That taper at the lecture talked about the Aryan Age, remember? And this one talks about the decline of the West. Blut und Boden, blood and earth, it's pure Nazism. It's not that simple, darling. This is a different continent. Thanks for the news. The Great White Fraternity. You eat your god for dinner. It's the Catholics who do that. It's not the same thing. It is, too. Weren't you listening? Pythagoras, Dante, the Virgin Mary, and the Masons? Always out to screw us. Make umbanda, not love. You're the one who's syncretized. Come on, let's have a look. This, too, is culture. There's only one culture. Strangle the last priest with the entrails of the last Rosicrucian. Allier signaled us to go in. If the outside was seedy, the inside was a blaze of violent colors. It was a quadrangular hall, with one area set aside for the dancing of the cavallos. The altar was at the far end, protected by a railing against which stood the platform for the drums, the atabax. The ritual space was still empty, but on our side of the railing a heterogeneous crowd was already stirring. Believers and the merely curious, blacks and whites, all mixed, some barefoot, others wearing tennis shoes. I was immediately struck by the figures around the altar, Pretos Velos, caboclos in multicolored feathers, saints who would have seemed to be marzipan were it not for their Pantagruelian dimensions. St. George in a shining breastplate and scarlet cloak, Saints Cosmas and Damien, a virgin pierced by swords, and a shamelessly hyper-realist Christ, his arms outstretched like the Redeemer of Corcovado, but in color. There were no Orixash, but you could sense their presence in the faces of the crowd, and in the sweetish odor of cane and cooked foods, in the stench of sweat caused by the heat and by the excitement of the imminent hira. The Padre Santo went forward and took a seat near the altar, where he received the faithful, scenting them with dense exhalations of his cigar, blessing them, and offering them a cup of liquor as if in a rapid Eucharistic rite. I knelt and drank with my companions, noticing, as I watched a Cambon pour the liquid from the bottle, that it was Dubonnet. No matter, I savored it as if it were an elixir from the fountain of youth. On the platform, the Atabaks were already beating, to brisk blows, as the initiates chanted a propitiatory song to Exu and to Pompahira. Seu tranco ruas e mohuba, e mohuba, e mohuba, sete encrucilladas e mohuba, e mohuba, e mohuba, seu maraboy e mohuba, se tiriri e mohuba, Exu veludo e mohuba, a Pompahira e mohuba. The Pai de Santo began to swing his thurible, releasing a heavy odor of Indian incense, and to chant special orations to Oxalá and Nossa Senora. The Atabaks beat faster, and the cavallos invaded the space before the altar, beginning to fall under the spell of the pantos. Most were women, and Amparo made sarcastic asides about the sensitivity of her sex. Among the women were some Europeans. Allier pointed out a blonde, a German psychologist who had been participating in the rites for years. She had tried everything, but if you are not chosen, it's hopeless. For her, the trance never came, was beyond achieving. Her eyes seemed lost in the void as she danced, and the Atabaks gave neither her nerves nor ours any relief. Pungent fumes filled the hall and dazed both worshippers and observers, somehow hitting everybody, me included, in the stomach. But the same thing had happened to me at the Escolas de Samba in Rio. I knew the psychological power of music and noise, the way they produce Saturday night fevers in discos. The German woman's eyes were wide, and every movement of her hysterical limbs begged for oblivion. The other daughters of the saint went into ecstasy, flung their heads back, wriggled fluidly, navigating a sea of forgetfulness. The German tensed, distraught and almost in tears, like someone desperately struggling to reach orgasm, wriggling and straining but finding no release. However much she tried to lose control, she constantly regained it. Poor Teuton, sick from too many well-tempered clavichords. The elect, meanwhile, were making their leap into the vacuum, their gaze dulled, their limbs stiffened, their movements became more and more automatic, but not haphazard, because they revealed the nature of the beings taking possession of them. Some of the elect seemed soft, their hands moving sideways, palms down in a swimming motion. Others were bent over and moved slowly, and the Kambones used white linen cloths to shield them from the crowd's view, for these had been touched by an excellent spirit. Some of the cavallos shook violently, and those possessed by Pretos Velos emitted hollow sounds, hum, 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 as they moved with their bodies tilted forward like old men leaning on canes, jaws jutting out in haggard, toothless faces. But those possessed by the caboclos let out shrill warrior cries, Yahoo! And the Kambones rushed to assist the ones unable to bear the violence of the gift. The drums beat, the pantos rose in the air thick with fumes. I was holding Amparo's arm, when all of a sudden her hands were sweating, her body trembled, her lips parted. I don't feel well, she said. I want to go. Allier noticed what had happened and helped me take her outside. The night air brought her around. I'm all right, she said. It must have been something I ate. And the smells, the heat. No, said the Pai de Santo, who had followed us. You have the qualities of a medium. You reacted well to the pantos. I was watching you. Stop, Amparo cried, adding a few words in a language I didn't know. I saw the Pai de Santo turn pale, or gray, as they used to say in adventure stories, where men with black skin turned gray with fear. That's enough. I got a little sick. I ate something I shouldn't have. Please, go back inside. Just let me get some air. I'd rather be by myself. I'm not an invalid. We did as she asked, but when I went back inside, after the break in the open air, the smells, the drums, the sweat that now covered every body, acted like a shot of alcohol gulped down after a long abstinence. I ran a hand over my brow, and an old man offered me an agogo, a small gilded instrument like a triangle with bells, which you strike with a little bar. Go up on the platform, he said. Play, it'll do you good. There was homeopathic wisdom in that advice. I struck the agogo, trying to fall in with the beat of the drums, and gradually I became part of the event, and, becoming part of it, I controlled it. I found relief by moving my legs and feet. I freed myself from what surrounded me. I challenged it. I embraced it. Later, Allier was to talk to me about the difference between the man who knows and the man who undergoes. As the mediums fell into trances, the Kambones led them to the sides of the room, sat them down, offered them cigars and pipes. Those of the faithful who had been denied possession ran and knelt at their feet, whispered in their ears, listened to their advice, received their beneficent influence, poured out confessions, and drew comfort from them. Some hovered at the edges of trance, and the Cambones gently encouraged them, leading them, now more relaxed, back among the crowd. In the dancing area, many aspirants to ecstasy were still moving. The German woman twitched unnaturally, waiting to be visited, in vain. Others had been taken over by Exu and were making wicked faces, sly, astute, as they moved in jerks. It was then that I saw Amparo. Now I know that Chesed is not only the Sephirah of grace and love. As Diotelevi said, it is also the moment of expansion of the divine substance, which spreads out to the edge of infinity. It is the care of the living for the dead, but someone also must have observed that it is the care of the dead for the living. Striking the agogo, I no longer followed what was happening in the hall, focused as I was on my own control, letting myself be led by the music. Amparo must have come in at least 10 minutes before, and surely she had felt the same effect I had experienced earlier. But no one had given her an agogo, and by now she probably wouldn't have wanted one. Called by deep voices, she had stripped herself of all defenses, of all will. I saw her fling herself into the midst of the dancing, stop, her abnormally tense face looking upward, her neck rigid. Then, oblivious, she launched into a lewd saraband, her hands miming the offer of her own body. "A Pombahira! A Pombahira!" some shouted, delighted by the miracle, since until then the she-devil had not made her presence known. "O seu manto e de veludo, rebordado todo em uro, o seu garfo e de prata, muito grande e seu tesouri. Pombahira das almas, vem toma chocho." I didn't dare intervene. I may have accelerated the strokes of my little bar, trying to join carnally with my woman, or with the indigenous spirit she now incarnated. The Cambones went to her, had her put on the ritual vestment, and held her up as she came out of her brief but intense trance. They led her to a chair. She was soaked with sweat and breathed with difficulty. She refused to welcome those who rushed over to beg for oracles. Instead, she started crying. The hero was coming to an end. I left the platform and ran to Amparo. Alie was already there, delicately massaging her temples.
"How embarrassing," Amparo said. "I don't believe in it. I didn't want to. How could I have done this?"
"It happens," Alie said softly. "It happens."
"But then there's no hope," Amparo cried. "I'm still a slave."
"Go away," she said to me angrily.
"I'm a poor, dirty black girl. Give me a master. I deserve it."
"It happens to blonde Achaeans, too," Alie consoled her. "It's human nature." Amparo asked the way to the toilet. The rite was ending. The German woman was still dancing, alone in the middle of the hall, ostentatious but now listless. She had followed Amparo's experience with envious eyes. Amparo came back about 10 minutes later as we were taking our leave of the Pai de Santo, who congratulated us on the splendid success of our first contact with the world of the dead. Alie drove in silence through the night. When he stopped outside our house, Amparo said she wanted to go upstairs alone.
"Why don't you take a little walk?" she said to me. "Come back when I'm asleep. I'll take a pill. Excuse me, both of you. I really must have eaten something I shouldn't have. All those women tonight must have. I hate my country. Good night."
Alie understood my uneasiness and suggested we go to an all-night bar in Copacabana. At the bar, I didn't speak. Alie waited until I had started sipping my batida before he broke the silence. Alie waited until I had started sipping my batida before he broke the silence. "Race, or culture, if you prefer, is part of our unconscious mind. And in another part of that unconscious dwell archetypes, figures identical for all men and in all centuries. This evening, the atmosphere, the surroundings, lulled our vigilance. It happened to all of us. You felt it yourself. Amparo discovered that the Orixash, whom she has destroyed in her heart, still live in her womb. You must not think I consider this a positive thing. You have heard me speak respectfully of the supernatural energies that vibrate around us in this country. But I have no special fondness for the practices of possession. An initiate is not the same as a mystic. Being an initiate, having an intuitive comprehension of what reason cannot explain,
is a very deep process. It is a slow transformation of the spirit and of the body, and it can lead to the exercise of superior abilities, even to immortality, but it is secret, intimate. It does not show itself externally. It is modest, lucid, detached. That is why the masters of the world, initiates, do not indulge in mysticism. For them, a mystic is a slave, a sight of the manifestation of the numinous, through which sight the signs of a secret can be observed. The initiate encourages the mystic and uses him, as you might use a telephone, to establish long-distance contact, or as a chemist might use litmus paper, to detect the action of a particular substance. The mystic is useful because he is conspicuous. He broadcasts himself. Initiates, on the contrary, are recognizable only to one another. It is they who control the forces that mystics undergo. In this sense, there is no difference between the possession experienced by the Kavalos and the ecstasies of St. Teresa of Avila or St. John of the Cross. Mysticism is a degenerate form of contact with the divine, whereas initiation is the fruit of long ascesis of mind and heart. Mysticism is a democratic, if not demagogic, phenomenon. Initiation is aristocratic. It is mental as opposed to carnal? In a sense. Your Amparo was guarding her mind tenaciously, but she was not on guard against her body. The layperson is weaker than we are. It was late. Allier informed me that he was leaving Brazil. He gave me his Milan address. I went home and found Amparo asleep. I lay down beside her in silence, in the dark, and spent a sleepless night. It was as if there was an unknown being next to me. In the morning, Amparo told me that she was going to Petropolis to visit a girlfriend. We said goodbye awkwardly. She left with a canvas bag, a volume of political economy under her arm. For 2 months, she sent me no word, and I made no attempt to seek her out. Then she wrote me a brief, evasive letter, telling me she needed time to think. I didn't answer. I felt no passion, no jealousy, no nostalgia. I was hollow, clear-headed, clean, and as emotionless as an aluminum pot. I stayed in Brazil for another year with the constant feeling that I was on the brink of departure. I didn't see Allier again. I didn't see any of Amparo's friends. I spent long, long hours on the beach, sunbathing. I flew kites, which, down there, are very beautiful.